Right. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk about urban legends, too. And we've got some classic Carson every weekday morning at 2:30. We like to go back in time to the Johnny Carson show, which you can watch on Antenna TV every night, and play back some classic bits or sketches or stand-up. And we'll be listening to the great Robert Klein, and that'll happen at 2:30. And there it is. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. A couple of big movies premiered in homes, because that's the new thing now. People aren't going to the movies, and we also have some news stories to talk about in terms of that. AMC plans to reopen its theaters in July. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me. Eric, welcome.
Hello.
And
thank you.
Steve, welcome.
Hey there.
All right. How you guys holding up, Eric? How you holding up?
In that sort of that gray area now, where like it seemed like we were, you know, starting to kind of turn a corner a little bit. Now it seems like that's kind of being yanked back away from us for a little while, and the loss of the summer is not boding well.
Yeah.
For me, so that's really kind of disappointing. You know, think that we're gonna have to, you know, who knows how, you know, where this is gonna go from here. But I was hoping that, you know, the summer is going to be preserved a little bit.
Yeah, it's disappointing, but we got to do what we got to do, man.
Oh, totally.
So Steve, how about you, man?
I'm good. Like, I'm one of those nerds that's actually like tracking all the medical metrics in the state and in the city, and like every day I'm like looking at the updates, and I'm like, as much as the rest of the country might be going to hell in terms of cases going up again, we're doing really well, and we're still going down, and we're still like, and of course I'm watching it because I want to know when movie theaters are going to open up again, and in the state and in the city, and those are, we can talk about that later, but I'm just like, every day I'm like, wow, I can't believe that our numbers are getting better. And so as much as I am still kind of nervous walking around and driving around, it's I am a little bit encouraged by what I'm seeing, at least locally. So
okay. All right, well, we got to find a silver lining in any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's basically what it comes down to. Well, look, the movies are now premiering in people's houses, and two really big ones premiered this week. Two really big movies. Judd Apatow's latest with Pete Davidson, called The King of Staten Island. Eric, tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, this is Judd Apatow's latest film, and I guess Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live kind of, you know, talked to him, approached him about doing the story, and it's, you know, kind of, you know, semi-autobiographical story about Pete Davidson's life growing up in Staten Island. In the film, he plays a guy in his mid-20s, I think he's 24, still lives at home with his mom, played by Marissa Tomei. His younger sister is about to go off to college, so the two of them are going to be alone together. He hangs out with a bunch of his slacker pals. He is kind of hopeful he wants to someday be a tattoo artist. The things, you know, take a little bit of a turn when his mother meets, it's sort of his fault, a firefighter played by Bill Burr. The reason why this is such a big deal is that the story, we'll get into a little bit of Pete Davidson's past, but his father was killed. It was a fireman himself, and was killed on duty many years ago when he was a kid. And it's something that's still manifests in different ways, and still kind of traumatizes him a bit. Maybe leading to exactly where, you know, he is today and why he's, you know, he acts the way he does. But doesn't take too kindly to his mother dating this guy that was kind of a jerk to him when they first met. And he begins to start to try to break them up. while you know, continuing all these other storylines, including one involving a friend of his played by Belle Powley, who he has been sleeping with, but secretly he doesn't really want to let anyone know about it, and he's kind of dating her or sleeping with her on the side. And you know, that's sort of the general story that we get about Davis's life here. Judd Apatow, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Judd Apatow, you know, his films over the years, I had probably been a bit more of a Judd Apatow apologist more than anyone, especially with his directorial efforts, because the thing that I've always responded to in Apatow's films is just how funny they have been. 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up were on my top 10 list those years, and throughout the years, I just, even if his films have kind of failed to live up to the sort of the dramatic urgencies that you know, some of them have aspired to, I was particularly fond of Funny People at the time, even though many people complained about its length, and that's something that Apatow has struggled with, at least critically. No one's really told him to keep his movies under 2 hours, and this one is no exception, coming in about 2 hours and 17 minutes. But because of the laugh factor, I have always been very forgiving of his movies, because I've always found a good sense of enjoyment due to the comedic natures. And this one is certainly one that leans a little bit more into the dramatic side of things than his films of the past, with the exception of maybe Funny People. And I think this is one of the areas, the main area where I end up on the mixed side of this film, because I think that it's really, I was really struck early in the film when people who know Pete Davidson's backstory, that his father was a fireman who was killed during 9/11. And in the film, they take that element out of it, and they just say that he was killed in a hotel fire, which I thought was a really odd way of masking a real sense of sort of the true trauma in you know, what has manifested possibly in Pete Davidson's life. I think taking that one element away from it is, you know, a bit of a sidestep, kind of a bit of a, just kind of a glossing over of that. And I thought that was sort of an odd thing to do, because then it just becomes, you know, I mean, anyone losing their parent in a situation like that is obviously going to manifest itself in different ways, and it's not to be taken lightly. But the 9/11 factor is just such a much more giant cloud that I was really kind of stunned that they took that part out of it. And the dramatic stuff throughout the movie, I think, starts to wander. There's so many storylines going on in his life. I think there's stuff involving his friends, including a robbery that happens that I thought could have been excised from the film. I think Bill Burr is very good in this movie, but I think the screenplay, I think he gets to do more with the character as an actor than the script sort of fills in the central relationship between him and Pete Davidson.
Okay,
I think that there's,
Eric, hang on. Hang on.
Okay.
All right. We're going to hold on, and Eric will wrap it up, and then we'll get Steve's thoughts on this. And we've got some news stories to talk about in the world of movies as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Skyline studio. We're here till 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about some really crazy urban legends. Those are so much fun to talk about. And Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here. Two really big movies made their debut in our homes over the weekend, and we wanted to talk about those. Eric is here and Steve is
here.
Hello. All right, Eric, wrap it up on The King of Staten Island.
Yeah, okay. So as I was saying, back to the central relationship between Burr and Davidson, I thought Apatow was sort of missed the many opportunities to sort of, you know, talk about the sort of the idolized version of Davidson's father that he's built up his mind versus this reality that is now, you know, he's confronted with. And the fact that it takes, it's like almost like 80 minutes before they get to Davidson hanging around the fire department where his father used to work. That's where Steve Buscemi's chief character gets involved. And that sequence, that whole section of the movie, I thought was where everything was sort of converging at its best. But it comes so late in the proceedings, and I thought that if Apatow found a way to get that a little closer to the end of the first act or the beginning of the second act, we would have a lot more to work with in that arena. No one's particularly, I think everyone in the movie is good. I think Davidson is good in the movie. Burr is good. Marissa Tomei continues to just be effortless when it comes to, you know, characters like this. And the movie is generally funny throughout most of its running time. And that was something that was able to sort of, again, with Apatow's movies, sort of keep me on the verge of liking it. I don't dislike the movie, but I'm sort of right on the scale of mix on it, but I was a little bit aiming downwards.
Okay. All right, Steve?
Oh, I adore this movie. I adore it. And I don't think the fact that they didn't tell the Pete Davidson story word for word, minute by minute, it impacts in any way. The point of... It's an interesting thing about why they didn't choose to make the father die at 9/11. I mean, the thing that sort of pushes Scott or maybe holds him back through his whole life since his dad died is that he kind of worshipped his dad and never really understood why he would sacrifice himself for strangers instead of choosing a safer job and being there to watch his kids grow up. And if that had been a 9/11 hero, I think there are people in the audience that would actually resent him for feeling that way. So I think by having him die in a more ordinary fire makes sense to a certain degree. But also, that's only a part of this film, is him sort of getting over that hump. The more interesting thing is really there's a scene right near the beginning of the film where Scott is talking to the Belle Powley character who he's sleeping with, and she wants to date him. She wants to actually date him, and he's like, no, no, no. And he, at first we think, oh, he's just being like a jerky guy, but it turns out he says to her, I'm scared of myself. And it's that moment that we kind of knew, and I certainly knew, that this film was something different. And it's also about, it's more of a mental illness, like a type of PTSD that he suffered as a child. And he's afraid to get close to people, and he doesn't want to negatively impact these people that he's close with. And that's sort of the secret of this movie, is it's not trying to be as funny as other Judd Apatow films. And it works, I think, even better as a more dramatic thing. It's full of laughs. Don't get me wrong. Like, Bill Burr is tremendous here. I think he's really coming into his own. The casting in this film is incredible. Like, even Maude Apatow as the younger sister has really come into her own. Pamela Adlin is in this movie, which I don't even think I knew when I started to watch it. And she, as Bill Burr's ex-wife, oh my God, is she funny in this movie. But, like, over the course of the film, like, Scott just sort of gets called out for some of his bad behavior by these people that are really close to him. And there's no real villains in this film. Buscemi's amazing and sort of a guiding force for him. And in a weird way, it's like Judd Apatow has taken this sort of man-child persona that he really helped shape in his earlier films to a certain degree, and wonders, like, okay, how did these guys get this way in the first place? So, like, is there, like, sometimes there's a reason people don't grow up and don't leave home, and it's not always because they don't feel like it. And when the film, the film is not a complete downer at all, but it does provide us with a lot of food for thought, like kind of warming our hearts at the same time. So I think this is a real kind of a step forward for Apatow.
I'm with you, Steve. I think this movie's great. I thought it was just great. I thought it was funny and moving. I thought Pete Davidson was terrific. I mean, the entire cast is great.
Yeah.
But I just feel really old that Marissa Tomei is playing all these mother roles now. But anyway, I thought they touched upon I thought there was a real honesty to it, obviously because of the story and how sort of autobiographical it is. But I thought the casting, like you said, I thought the casting was really terrific, and everybody around it was good. And I too, Steve, did not know that Pamela Adlon was in the movie. And it just makes me happy to see her in anything.
Yeah.
And she's great in this. So is everybody. Bill Burr, again, you mentioned Bill Burr is great. And this is a great role for Pete Davidson. You know, for people who kind of maybe dismiss him as the silly young guy, the sort of stoner young guy on SNL, people are going to look at this in a completely different light, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it premiered in your house. So that's what's going to be happening now with movies. And so I highly recommend this movie. Okay. Steve, tell us about The Five Bloods.
Yeah, well, this is a good exercise in timing is everything. And then again, great filmmaking is great filmmaking no matter the surroundings. But in the case of director Spike Lee's latest, The Five Bloods, the film feels so of the moment in many ways. You could almost swear he made it yesterday. And it's a quality that it shares with even with Black Klansman, his last film. The film kind of opens with a quick recap of Black American history in the late 1960s, especially as it applies to the Vietnam War, but it also incorporates major events like moon landing and various speeches by notable Black leaders, many of whom were assassinated or otherwise silenced in this period. And it's a real just bucket of cold water to your face to kind of get you in the right mindset for what comes next. And there's so much footage of protests. It's kind of shocking as well. And again, it seems deliberate, but I'm pretty sure it was there weeks and weeks and months ago. The soundtrack of this, the first few minutes, by the way, we should mention is Marvin Gaye's Inner City Blues. And at a particular point, we hear this lyric where he says he's talking about trigger happy police. And again, I don't know if Spike Lee adjusted something in where that lands in the footage, but again, I don't think he changed anything. I think it's just incredible coincidence, but it really stands out. And actually, Marvin Gaye kind of serves as the large part of the soundtrack of the songs from his album What's Going On. And there's a particular sequence where there's sort of a vocal-only performance of that title track in a couple key scenes, and it just feels like the characters are entering like this dream and they don't necessarily want to be having it. So basically this is about four Black Vietnam veterans who return to Vietnam looking both for the remains of a fallen fifth member of their very tight-knit group, and they're also sort of secretly looking for some long buried by them crate of gold that they discovered during the war in a wreckage of a plane that was supposed to pay off their allies in country. And the squad leader, whose name is Stormin Norman, who's played by Chadwick Boseman, who we see in flashbacks, suggests they bury the gold and come back when things have cooled off, but it's taken like several decades for that to happen. So Lee favorite and supercharged Delroy Lindo plays Paul, who has turned fairly right wing over the years and even spends part of the film wearing a MAGA hat. He's clearly suffering from a great deal of mental trauma, refusing any kind of help. His son has sort of snuck on board this mission to look out for him, but also maybe to get a cut of the action. And he's played by Jonathan Majors, who was so good in The Last Black Man in San Francisco last year. And the other old friends are played by another Lee regular, Clark Peters, then Norm Lewis, and also Isaiah Whitlock, who, like Clark Peters, is a veteran of The Wire. And he seems to be the only one without any real deep, painful issues going into
Steve,
this journey.
Steve,
yeah,
hang
yeah.
on, hang on.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Eric and Steve are here, and we'll tell you what we all thought of The Five Bloods, which is Spike Lee's latest movie. And we've got some interesting movie-related news to get to as well. And that's coming up right here on WGN.
All right.
Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are also going to talk about some classic urban legends. And as part of the classic comedy that we always play from the Johnny Carson show, which you can watch every night on Antenna TV, we're going to play back some classic Robert Klein stand-up, one of the most legendary stand-up comedians of all time. Right now, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress are here, and two really big movies opened up in your house this past weekend, and we're talking about them. Here's Eric, and
Hello.
Here's Steve.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, continue. The Five Bloods, which is Spike Lee's latest.
Yeah, and so essentially what Spike Lee does is send his characters on sort of their own Heart of Darkness voyage, a scenario that's sort of underscored by a big Apocalypse banner, Apocalypse Now banner that we see in the background of the scene. But with every step, each man is kind of pushed a little deeper into their own personal hell, and sometimes that's physical pain, but usually it's more of an emotional thing. One of the most amazing mind-bending choices that Spike Lee makes here is to use the older actors, the lead actors, in the flashback scenes with Chadwick Boseman that are supposed to be taking place during the war. He doesn't get younger actors to play these guys. He gets the old guys, and it's kind of incredible. It's a weird thing to see, but it really does work. But it also makes us wonder, okay, can we even trust these memories? Because like Delroy Lindo's character says, he sees Chadwick Boseman's ghost every night and has long conversations with him. So we're not sure if what we're seeing is really sort of an idealized version of the events from the past, or if they're more factual. We're never 100% sure, but it might be some combination of both. But it's clear that everybody idolized Norman at the time, and it's just simply like, yeah, it's kind of incredible. So, strangely enough, in the film's final few sequences, it begins to like show signs of becoming more of an action movie. Delroy Lindo, if you could bottle what it is he's doing in this movie, you would never fall asleep again. If you drank it, Lee has done such impressive work getting us to care about these lost souls, and that the life or death stakes that are clearly happening during this adventure of theirs seem so much higher because of that. The commentary on history is not only rampant, but it seems strangely and disappointingly timeless. The criticisms of Nixon in this film fit pretty comfortably next to statements about our current president. And the film makes it crystal clear that the horrors of war aren't just about dying, because those who dead don't have to remember or feel the way the living people do, the people that survived it. So it's difficult to imagine a film better suited for this very day than this one, but I mean, I was just truly floored by this movie that you can watch on Netflix.
Yep, it's on Netflix. Eric, what do you think?
I think this is up there at Lee's best movies. I really do. I mean, you know, watching this movie, you can almost see or even hear Lee kind of smiling and laughing on just offset at the way that he's crafting this thing. As urgent as Steve describes this film, you can also see Lee having some fun with this movie as well. At some point, you'd be easy enough if you were to make a mistake that Quentin Tarantino made this movie. It's so chock filled with references and homages and things like that, but at the same time, it is, unmistakably a Spike Lee movie. All these flashbacks and things, the history, inserting all these people who have died over the years, fighting for causes that ultimately, gained them nothing. And it's really this whole great, statement about the Vietnam War, and also how things have just not changed, that, people are still fighting for things that is not going to amount to much, in the end. The idea of the Delroy Lindo character actually, turning to, the politics that he does in the movie is also, this grander statement about people who have been left behind and, what the hell, let's take a chance on this and see if, maybe this is something that, we can finally just look out for ourselves for change, which is, connected to all the gold in the movie. This movie it's funny at times. It is exhausting at times. Delroy Lindo, someone would have to point me to a time when he did not give a good performance, or an urgent performance, even in throwaway roles. This is a performance of a lifetime for him. And it's just going to be watching him get the recognition he's getting for this movie is so long overdue. And it feels like it's like kind of Steve kind of referenced that it has been like kind of put in a bottle all this time. And Lee just unleashed it all in this movie. Yeah, this is definitely one of the best movies I've seen this year.
There's no question about it. It's a great movie. It is absolutely great. And Spike is on a roll right now.
Yeah.
I think this is one of Spike's best movies. And everybody in it is amazing. But God, Delroy Lindo. Oh my God, what a performance! I mean, seriously, like jaw dropping. This movie runs over 2.5 hours. It doesn't feel like it. It covers every possible emotion. And you know, I mean, we talk about how great Delroy Lindo is, but everybody is great in this movie. Like all the performances are terrific. It is it's funny at times. It's heartbreaking at times. It's nerve wracking. And it is, I think it's one of the best movies of the year. And I think it's one of Spike's best movies. Man. And again, I just want to emphasize how great Spike Lee is doing right now. Like the last few movies that he's made are unbelievable. And this ranks as one of the best movies he's ever done, with a remarkable cast, and they're all good. It's a Spike Lee movie through and through. Like, you never would doubt who directed this movie while you're watching it. But it's on a whole nother level. I just think it's amazing. It's on Netflix now. Prepare yourself, because it's a pretty heavy experience to watch, although it's not completely, you know, like depressing or anything like that. But this is one that's gonna stay with you. There's no question about it. And it's one of the best movies of the year.
Did any of you catch the Temptations references? Someone pointed this out to me, that the names of the four lead characters are all the original four names of the and then when one of them left, David Ruffin came in, and that's the name of the son.
Right.
Right.
And then Norman is named after Norman Whitfield, who produced all their earliest hits.
Right.
So,
right.
But what, I don't know what it has to do with the whole movie, but it's still pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. The Five Bloods, Spike Lee's latest. Can't recommend it highly enough. It's available on Netflix. Tom, you watched it, right?
I did, yes. I've actually been on a huge Spike Lee kick. I've gone through almost his entire filmography, save for the documentaries they did.
Yeah.
Just to try and prepare myself for this. You know, I really fell in love with Delroy Lindo in Clockers. He's awesome in Clockers.
He's great in everything.
He's amazing. He's incredible. But
he's great in Congo.
Yeah. But I will say, in terms of Spike Lee, I loved him in Clockers, and he's even better in this. I also enjoyed the fact that they did not get younger actors or do any de-aging.
Interesting thing, man.
Yeah, Steve hit the nail on the head. Exactly what Steve said about how can we, you know, what are these memories?
Yeah.
Can we trust them? That's exactly what went through my mind while watching it. And just the idea of these guys, they should appear as themselves in their older age next to the younger Norman, because Norman never got to grow old.
Right.
And I thought that was really important, that we idolize people as their younger selves, but also it's tragic because you would never know what Norman would look like older, because he shall not grow old.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I was as uproarious in my praise for it. I think it's great. I think it's I'm really glad that we got this perspective on Vietnam, because we never get to talk about it. And we think that Vietnam's kind of a closed book in terms of cinema,
because
it's like, okay, we have Apocalypse Now, Platoon, you know,
Deer Hunter,
really, what else needs to be said? This needed to be said. This is the movie that needed to be made.
It's a great movie.
So it's great.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And that's The Five Bloods, which is available on Netflix now. Can't recommend it highly enough. Okay, what do you guys think about AMC? They plan to reopen their theaters in July. Steve, what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm surprised they're waiting that long, because I think at least in Illinois, they're going to be able to, or in a lot of states, actually, they're going to be able to open a lot sooner than that if they want to. But I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure that's everything. It's a tentative plan. I'm really curious to know. I mean, what's going to be really interesting is that if, like, when they open, because Tenet now has moved its release date back 2 weeks.
That's the new Christopher Nolan movie.
Christopher Nolan film was supposed to open in the middle of the month, now opening the last Friday of July. If it's entirely possible that at a place like River East that has 21 screens, that all 21 screens could be playing the same movie. And I mean, that's certainly what they're talking about. What's interesting just in terms of Illinois and Chicago is that if things progress the way they are, the rest of Illinois gets to open their movie theaters in less than two weeks. And there's still what originally they had said was it was only going to be a 50-person limit, but I'm now hearing that the governor and his team are going to change that to 50%. But then we're dealing now with the city of Chicago, which has altered rules slightly and delayed things slightly, which I am now hearing will be more like July 1st, which, again, is less than a week after that. That's fine. But I'm hearing, at least right now, they're sticking to that 50-person thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, there might be some theaters that don't open right away because that isn't going to help them very much. I don't think that's – maybe River East it would if they played the same movie on all 50 screens and people, you know, came out. But,
yeah.
But, like, I don't think it's even economically feasible for the Music Box to open if it's a 50-person cap. So – so yeah, so and I know that the theater owners in Chicago are really pressing the city to consider that 50% thing. Although I think the Music Box would be more like 250 people. It's like a third.
Sure.
But because I don't think they I don't think we'd want half, but yeah, and you know, there's still so much up in the air. And so much being figured out, but man, like I said, the numbers are so good in Illinois and Chicago right now that hopefully that will happen. But honestly, I'm not one of these people. I'm ready to go back. I will be back the day those theaters open if there's something to go see.
Yeah.
So it's something worth going to see. Like I wish I had seen the Spike Lee movie in a big theater.
I think we all wish
good Lord.
That.
Yeah. I hope that still makes it in somehow. But. Yeah.
All right, Eric, where do you stand on this?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, sort of Steve's kind of reference, you know, there's almost like a per capita kind of thing. You know, I mean, Music Box is, you know, a treasure and is a very large auditorium. So 50 people versus 50% is a much bigger difference there.
Though,
as I've sort of talked to some people who work in theaters and things like that, you know, multiplexes, the idea that what I've been hearing is that, you know, a lot of theaters are going to be open, and I've heard, like a 25% way of opening up these theaters. And, you know, with the exception of like the big movies that open in the first couple of weeks, I've been told that a lot of the multiplexes, you know, 25% is usually what you kind of get on weekdays and weekends, for some of the smaller theaters in those chains. I mean, the Elk Grove Cinema, the one that's, you know, very close to my home, they're actually opening a little bit sooner than July. I think it's the last week of June that they're opening. And like many theaters are kind of having this sort of come back when movie theaters are open, come back to us, are going to be playing all of these, older movies, classic movies, modern movies. Even, you know, now that Warner Brothers has moved Tenant, they're going to be opening Inception in its place for its 10th anniversary. So I think everyone's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of bet hedging going on right now. I think Warner Brothers kind of blinked just a couple days ago. And I think that's going to, you know, they're now sort of putting the onus on Disney with Mulan. Like, okay, you guys open first and see how you guys
do.
So I think that's kind of what's going on right now. And I don't think that we've seen the last of those changes. I think that you're going to see Disney blink next.
Mulan is blinking next. I have no doubt Mulan is blinking now.
Oh, without question.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. Guys, thanks so much, okay? Stay safe.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Eric thanks. And Steve, we thank you guys. Interesting idea here that AMC is going to reopen their theaters in July. The question is, will people go? Phone lines are open. Would you go? Do you feel safe enough to go back to the theater and see a movie? I got an article here from Variety that says 70% of consumers would rather watch new movies at home. I got that, but I want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Do you feel safe to go back? Are you going to go back? Are you excited to go back to the movies? Obviously, there are going to be, you know, restrictions and rules, you know, safe distancing and all that stuff. And I know people are hungry to get back to their normal lives. I know that. So I don't know. 312-981-7200. Will you be going out to the movies when the theaters reopen? I'll talk a little bit about this article from Variety about how 70% of consumers would rather watch new movies at home. But are you ready to get back into the theater? 312-981-7200 is the number. We want to hear from you.